Welcome to Financial Perspectives, the podcast. Join the team at Foster Group and our expert guests as we explore a variety of subjects that could impact your financial life. We will cover timely economic and financial market news, a wide range of personal financial planning ideas, and investment topics. Ultimately, we want to encourage educated optimism and do our best to provide valuable insights to help you navigate your financial journey with confidence. Please stick around at the end for important disclosure information. More information about Foster Group can be found in our ADV brochure at fostergrp.com.
When markets feel uncertain, it's a good time to check our anchor and make sure we're still grounded in what matters. Today, we'll step back and focus on how markets actually work, how expectations are priced, and what history suggests truly matters when navigating periods of heightened volatility. Joining us to discuss these topics is Wes Krill. Wes is Vice President and Senior Client Solutions Director for Dimensional Fund Advisors Global Client Group. He is a frequent speaker at Dimensional and industry events and translates the company's research insights for its websites and social media. Wes previously spent over a decade on Dimensional's research team, conducting research on a wide range of investment initiatives and questions about the broad investment landscape and Dimensional strategies. He is a graduate of North Carolina State University, where he earned his Bachelor of Science and PhD in Materials Science Engineering. Wes, thank you for joining us on Financial Perspectives today. To get things started, let's go back to the February 28 date when the Iran conflict began. What are the key developments that you're watching as it relates to the conflict?
I think the first is just that to reassure our investors, it's perfectly reasonable to be concerned about all these headlines. I mean, there's a famous expression that you never win a war any more than you win an earthquake. And I think that's something for people to keep in mind is the human element of this is very much relevant for investors to be thinking about. But when it comes to your portfolios, I think that's where I would tend to draw a distinction in terms of what we're doing here at Dimensional. There's not a whole lot that I think is really an implication for the equity side of things. This is a little bit different than the Russia conflict where there was potential sanctions that would have been relevant for our investment portfolios. Fixed income, clearly there's things we look at when it comes to changes in interest rates and changes in yield curve positioning. But I think the most relevant takeaways for investors are really just this idea of remaining disciplined and remembering that these kind of conflicts, whether it's geopolitical risks, whether it's macroeconomic risks, these are the reasons why you get paid an equity premium, right? I mean, these are the things that are going to factor into market volatility. And, you know, the reward for bearing the risk associated with these kind of conflicts and the volatility that they might drive in stock returns is a big part of why you're getting the equity premium in the first place. And as I always like to remind investors, the equity premium is a very critical part that most of us are going to need to grow our savings that we have today into a nest egg that we can afford to consume in the future.
As a follow-up, can you break down the definition of equity premium for our listeners that might be unfamiliar with the term?
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, if you think about risk and return being related, what that implies is that the market in aggregate is going to demand a higher rate of return to take on more risk. This is not unlike if you have a whole population of people who go to a bank to secure a loan. They might not all get the same interest rate. You might have higher interest rates for people who the bank considers riskier to lend to, and lower interest rates to people who they feel are safer to lend to. And this is the same idea with the distinction between the required rate of return for stocks versus bonds. Stocks are riskier than bonds. There's no two ways around it. They have higher return volatility. There's really no horizon over which you're guaranteed to get any return on your principal. It's not like with a bond where you get a stated interest rate and you get repayment of your principal at a certain date in the future. With equities, there's really no such investment time frame over which you're insured a rate of return. And so because of that, investors are going to demand a higher rate of return to invest in stocks than bonds. They will not generally do that for the same rate of return. And that difference in return, the higher return you get for stocks versus bonds, is what we call the equity premium, or the premium associated with bearing equity market risk.
Wes, as you look to the markets now, where might investors be prone to mistakes?
Well, I think there's a couple of things that, you know, are potential sticking points when it comes to investors. The first is just concern broadly for the world that they are sort of extrapolating from when it comes to thinking about their investments, because it's perfectly reasonable to think, okay, I'm concerned about the direction of the economy. I'm concerned about this war and the developments there, and then think you should be doing something about it in your portfolios. But the difference is that markets are forward-looking. They already have taken into account whatever information is known. The very things that we consider concerning headlines are things that the market has been pricing in. And because of that, they've already set prices to a level where that equity premium I mentioned earlier is by definition going to be positive. You can think of it as markets have kind of moved on to whatever the next big piece of news is going to be. And so that's why it's so challenging. I mean, if we think back to so-called Liberation Day back in 2025 in April, where a lot of the tariff policies started to become communicated, and there was a big market downturn that day, and I'm sure a lot of investors would have thought, well, you know, is this something I need to react to as well by making changes in my asset allocation and maybe divesting some from the stock market? Well, if you were to do that, you know, if you, let's say, got out of markets just for 1 week, starting on Liberation Day, well, the total return for the U.S. market that year was about 17%. You would have cut that down to about 12% if you were to be out of the market just for that 1 week. If you stayed out of the market for 1 month, instead of getting 17% return for the year, you would have been down under 5%. So, you know, that's really the opportunity cost for investors deviating from markets when they're concerned about the state of you know, anything that's newsworthy, I think is one of the key things that investors want to guard against.
We will likely touch more on that planning later in the conversation, but what I'm hearing you say is that it's important to pick a level of equity exposure during the asset allocation process that you're comfortable with in all market environments, so you don't react emotionally to the short-term volatility and miss out on the longer-term gains.
Yeah, you want to be aware of what the range of outcomes could be, how much the volatility could be over a given period of time, what's the level of loss you could have over, say, a 6 or 12 month period. And then I think that should factor into what your long-term asset allocation is, because not everyone is equally well-suited to tolerating equity market volatility, just like not everyone is equally well-suited to the spiciness level of certain peppers, right? I mean, if you think about whether I'm going to cook with a poblano pepper, a jalapeno, or a habanero, that's a personal decision. The underlying component ingredient that conveys that spice is capsaicin. It's the same whether it's the hottest pepper in the world or the mildest pepper in the world, but my sensitivity to it is going to dictate which one I choose. And it's the same idea with your long-term asset allocation, where maybe you're not 100% stocks, maybe you're not 0% stocks, but it's somewhere in between, and that landing point should really be a long-term decision so that when the market volatility does arise, you're not as tempted to flee for the exit door.
Great example. Yeah, you mentioned Liberation Day and the volatility around that event. How are you thinking about how the markets have responded this time around to the conflict in Iran?
Yeah, that's been sort of an interesting kind of viewpoint on it, because if we look at the VIX index, this is sometimes called Wall Street's fear factor, fear gauge. It's a measurement of the expected volatility over the next 30 days for the S&P 500. So you can think about that as the market in aggregate, their expectations of volatility. And the level of that index spiked on Liberation Day to over 52. Now, to put that in context, we really haven't seen anything even close to that level. You know, we often think of high for that gauge of being maybe 25 to 30. So getting up to 52 is pretty high level. We hadn't seen a level that high since the onset of the COVID pandemic in 2020, when it was over 80, which is the highest I've seen in the data going back to 93. And there was also a big spike in that around the global financial crisis of, I can't remember the numbers, like 65, 70, something like that. So, you know, for those numbers to give you some context for what we've seen recently, that is what I think of as high. That's an elevated expectation for volatility. In more recent days, we've seen that number a little bit elevated, but only around 24 or 25. So certainly it doesn't seem like there's the same level of uncertainty for financial markets as what we saw with those previous periods. Now, you know, expected volatility is not always the same as realized volatility. We could have further developments in the news cycle that are even more disappointing for markets, and you could see that expected volatility level spike. But so far, it doesn't seem at the same level as those previous periods of consternation.
Are there any historical events that you think are significant to inform this conflict?
Yeah, I mean, the challenge with these geopolitical conflicts is they come in all different shapes and sizes. Some of them are probably more severe than other ones. You know, we went back and looked at dozens of geopolitical conflicts historically and just looked at the average U.S. market return following the onset of those. And it was pretty optimistic when it comes to market returns on average. And the 12-month U.S. stock return following the onset of these conflicts was about 12%. So, you know, pretty good outcome from markets. To me, the closest thing, at least in my experience, in terms of the resemblance to what we're seeing nowadays is the COVID pandemic, because, you know, you had kind of the ominous loss of life element to it, which was very sad, very disappointing. And there was also the feeling of, well, you know, this is out of our control. Where exactly is this going to go? So a lot of uncertainty around it. Clearly more uncertainty if you go just by the VIX numbers. But, you know, I think that is a good example of the importance of staying invested, because March was a brutal month in 2020. But then we look at what happened to markets after March of 2020. And from April through the end of the year, we had really strong performance. In fact, the U.S. market ended up positive for the year, despite having that big 30% downturn, which, by the way, dwarfs what we've seen in terms of the downturn so far. I think last I'd seen it was around 7 or 8%, you know, peak to trough down decline this year. So, you know, that's one that always sticks out in mind. One, just for the parallel, for just the disappointment of the news cycle, but also just the importance of that lesson of staying invested.
Inflation is interesting here also, if you compare it to COVID. In 2020, we had supply chain constraints and government stimulus, both of which were inflationary. You know, now we are concerned about it for a slightly different reason, more in terms of energy costs, but it still affects the economic outlook, profitability, and expected returns. It's kind of the same pressure, but different causes this time around.
It does. And, you know, you can kind of see sort of some of the market's perception around the possibility of inflation through when we look at like what we call federal funds futures. And so these are futures contracts. It's a way for investors to kind of bet on the direction of market prices for various assets. And in the case of the federal funds rate, these Fed funds futures tell us basically what the market thinks is the likelihood of the Fed setting the federal funds rate at certain levels into the future. And if you look at the December meeting, so, you know, if you looked at the pricing around these contracts at the beginning of the year, it would have told you in no uncertain terms that the market expected multiple cuts for the federal funds rate by the Fed. And nowadays, it's looking like they really don't even expect any kind of cut. And that tells you everything, because the Fed is sensitive to the possibility of inflation, and, you know, their rate change decisions will be heavily influenced by what the expectation is for inflation. So, you know, I think there is a reigniting of the concerns around that, not as high maybe necessarily as what we saw during the COVID period when you had supply chain disruption very broadly. This one is much more specific to a handful of commodities, you know, such as oil. And some others, too. They're involved in, like, plastics making, you know, semiconductor chips, things like that. So could there be fallout from it? Possibly. But again, that's where you get to, what are the implications for me as an investor? You know, how should this change anything I'm doing? And again, I get back to this concept that, you know, these are not developments that are only known to a handful of people. This is broadly recognized news and implications for financial markets. And that means the markets have priced them in. So it doesn't mean that the stocks of these sectors that would be sensitive to these developments are necessarily going to suffer. In fact, you know, we see, even when you see periods of rising oil prices, the performance of energy stocks, while it's correlated with energy price or with oil price changes, doesn't really explain a lot of the variation in energy sector stock returns. There's a lot of stuff that's going to play into market performance. And so another reason why investors probably should be disciplined, even if they are pessimistic about the direction of things.
I know, I spent 20 years as an international equity analyst covering consumer companies, so I agree with what you're saying, but I also think that these pressures do show up on corporate income statements in ways that sometimes you least expect, whether it's in the packaging costs or transportation required to move the product around the globe. The longer this goes on, the more likely some companies will face margin pressure. And that's a good segue to my next question on duration. There's a lot of focus on duration. We know President Trump is anxious to wrap up this conflict as quickly as possible. The markets are watching this largely because the longer these influences are in play, the more of a problem they become. Wes, how are you and your colleagues talking about duration as it relates to the economic outlook and how that informs the outlook for the markets?
I think it's just as challenging to predict in the near term as it is in the long term. I mean, if we look at, for example, futures, again, I go back to this idea of futures markets, which tells you something about the market's viewpoint at longer term time horizons. We do see that there's an expectation for oil prices to fall over the coming year. So, those things carry an incredible amount of uncertainty. They really don't do that good of a job of predicting the future, because so much about the future is going to take form based on things that emerge down the line and we can't necessarily see today. So, I look at it as, whether it gets resolved in the short term or the long term, whatever we know about the conflict is reflected in market prices today. This is sort of in line with, when we saw following Liberation Day, we knew which countries were going to be particularly hit hard by the tariff policies. And we know there's going to be economic implications. This is not to say that, to your point, it's not to say that income statements are going to emerge from all of this completely unscathed for every business. But there's a difference between those economic impacts and the ultimate financial market impacts, because the market is forward looking. And, the three countries that were hit hardest by the tariff policies, Canada, Mexico, and China, all three of those countries had better stock market returns than the U.S. in 2025, despite, what I would call maybe dwindling economic expectations for those countries. So, and that's another thing for investors to keep in mind, is the impact on the economy is not necessarily the same as the impact on your portfolio, because these impacts are going to be felt throughout the economy over months or maybe even years. Markets make you feel it straight away, and then they move on to whatever the next crisis is going to be.
That's a really good point about the international market performance in the face of tariffs. What do you think about the Middle East and what makes it unique when it comes to geopolitical tension compared to other areas of the world?
I think it's an area that's sort of just ripe for conflict in general, because you do have a lot of warring factions, different religious viewpoints, very strong leadership in some ways, maybe more of a totalitarian type of view compared to more of a democratic way of running a government. So, because you've had areas that frankly have been in conflict for many generations, that it's this is unfortunately where you might see something like that emerge. And it, when you combine that with the fact that it's also a hotbed for commodity, both procurement, production, but also the passage through that strait, you got a lot of potential choke points there. And, it's unfortunate that things pan out this way. But, again, that's, if you're invested long enough, you're going to have these kind of events. Our founder, David Booth, often used to say every 10 years you get a big one. And what he meant by that was a big downward turn in markets. So I think that's just something you have to be prepared for as an investor. And there's another reason why we have global diversification, because it's not to say that the U.S. is immune to this. It's always possible that you could have developments like this, even in larger, more mature countries that we think of as being more democratic. And so a globally diversified portfolio will help you, such that if there's a disappointing stretch for one market's return, that could be buoyed by the returns you get elsewhere.
So moving in a slightly different direction, sometimes we lose sight of the mechanics of the market. I was reading a piece you published at Dimensional, and the phrase, markets always set prices for positive expected returns, stood out to me. Professional investors and retail investors alike can lose sight of these few words and how important they are when it comes to investing, given all the noise. Can you talk about the intuition behind these words?
So, what we mean by the expected return on the market is, in aggregate, what is the marketplace demanding as a rate of return to hold stocks broadly in a broadly diversified basket of stocks. And so, that's an important concept, because it's a natural equilibrium. Like, the reason why prices reach an equilibrium is because you can think of it as half the market thinks the price is too high, half the market thinks the price is too low. And that stabilizing effect is what gives you a positive expected return. And again, this is relevant if I think about, as I move through time, where as new news becomes available, let's say that the new, I'm a glass half empty guy, so I'll go on the negative side. Let's say there's a negative development when it comes to news that is relevant for stock prices. Let's say that there is a geopolitical conflict that's emerging, or we get particularly bad news about the macro economy, whatever the case may be. What that means is, whatever the price was, that equilibrium price that yesterday would give investors a positive expected return, today investors no longer believe that's a fair price, that now not as many people want to be buyers and sellers. Well, you can't have more buyers than sellers. There's an adding up constraint. So because of that, what has to happen to market prices in order to induce some of those buyers to get back off of the sidelines and start investing again, the price has to fall. So how much does it have to fall? Well, it has to fall to the point where investors now believe in aggregate they have a positive expected return again. Because remember, you're not going to have people buying stocks without a positive expected return. And so what that means is, whatever the outlook is on the world, good, bad, or indifferent, that you're going to have a positive expected return because that's the what the market demands in order to hold stocks.
That's such a good reminder that constant discovery of the equilibrium is determining prices in the market.
And you see, you know, prices move all the time because of that. And it's not just at the aggregate market level. I mean, sometimes there's good examples with single stock examples where, like, for example, the last 2 years, NVIDIA has reported their second quarter earnings. And I mean, you're talking about revenues. In 2024, the revenues were over $30 billion. They were even higher in 2025. What happened to their stock price in both instances? Well, it fell. And what it meant, what that tells you is that the market had an expectation, it had set the price accordingly. And even as big as those numbers were, they weren't enough to exceed investor expectations. And what that meant was the price had to fall so that investors thought they were getting a fair rate of return to hold shares of that company. And so that's, to your point, this is price discovery. Information becomes known, the market reacts, either positively or negatively. Prices move to accommodate that information and whatever its implications are for expected returns. And then at that point, you have a positive expected return again. And that's really the beauty of financial markets.
That's a great explanation. So if we go back to planning, you know, it's easy to stay the course with an investment plan when times are good. It's always a bit more difficult in situations such as the current environment. What does historical market performance tell us about how we should behave through volatility?
Well, we know that market downturns are not uncommon. In fact, I think I alluded to this stat earlier, but over the past 47 years, we've seen 26 calendar years in the U.S. where the peak to trough decline at some point during the year has been at least 10%. And so it's important for investors to be prepared for this, to have expectations set properly. So they know there's going to be a downturn. If you're an equity investor long enough, you're probably going to go through one of these periods. The really key aspect is to not react with your asset allocation because, again, if I go back to that example, 26 out of the last 47 years with a downturn of at least 10%, of those 26, 18 of them ended up being positive for the full year. So what that tells us is that markets, even if they have a downturn, can bounce back really quickly. And an investor that reacts by divesting from equity markets following a downturn could miss out on some of that clawback and miss out on a good portion of the equity market's return over time. So that's why we always try and preach discipline. Now, to your point, that's very difficult to stick with when you're in one of these very volatile periods. And I think this is really where that having objective financial advice, having a trusted financial advisor to really help steer you through this is invaluable. It might not seem like, okay, you know, how much are they actually helping me through the good periods? What they're doing is protecting you from yourself in the bad periods. And that is worth a lot of money because, like I mentioned earlier, I mean, just going back to Liberation Day, and if an investor reacted and stayed out of the market for a whole month, I mean, they lost like a third or more of, more than half of their overall return for the year. And that's a very steep price to pay.
Well, I think that's a good note to end on. Thoughtful planning for sure can be beneficial in uptrending markets, but may be more valuable during periods of correction. And we don't have to look back any further than 2025 for a good example of intra-year volatility. Wes, thanks so much for joining us today.
Yeah, absolutely.
The conversation was a great reminder that history tells us markets have a remarkable ability to adapt, recalibrate, and move forward. And that periods like this often set the stage for future opportunity. Throughout the investment journey, staying grounded in fundamentals, maintaining discipline, and keeping decisions aligned with a personalized financial plan really matters. As always, if there are topics you'd like us to cover in a future episode, please use our email, perspectives@fostergrp.com. And if you're listening on our podcast, would you consider giving us a like or share with your friends? That's all for now. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.
The previous presentation by Foster Group was intended for general information purposes only. No portion of the presentation serves as the receipt of, or as a substitute for, personalized investment advice from Foster Group or any other investment professional of your choosing. Different types of investments involve varying degrees of risk, and it should not be assumed that future performance of any specific investment or investment strategy, or any non-investment related or planning services, discussion, or content, will be profitable, be suitable for your portfolio or individual situation, or prove successful. Foster Group is neither a law firm nor accounting firm, and no portion of its services should be construed as legal or accounting advice. No portion of the content should be construed by a client or prospective client as a guarantee that he or she will experience a certain level of results if Foster Group is engaged, or continues to be engaged, to provide investment advisory services.
A copy of Foster Group's current written disclosure brochure discussing our advisory services and fees is available upon request or at www.fostergrp.com/disclosures.